They're way less opposed than I thought.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's February 24th. We have one bill to hear and an informational meeting today. We are waiting for paperwork on the bill and some amendments, so we're going to put that off until we have those in front of us and start with our informational meeting. So I'm going to open that informational meeting and invite Dr. Bertini forward. Colleagues, I had the chance to hear some of Dr. Bertini's presentation before, and particularly following up on some hearings that we had during the 2013 session around autonomous vehicles and the future of transportation. I thought it was a timely and relevant topic for us, particularly as we close in on the end of this session and think about what transportation looks like in the future. So, Dr. Bertini, we appreciate you being here, and we're eager to hear what you have to say.
Good afternoon, and Representative Reed and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity, and hopefully we can have a little bit of a discussion. I'm definitely open to your questions. I put together some materials that provide some background and some fuel for that conversation, but it is exciting to think about the future of transportation and what it can do for our economy and for our state and for our nation, and I just ask you to think about
Sorry to interrupt. Just before you start, we have this odd tradition here. We need you to introduce yourself for our record, too.
Of course. My name is Robert Bertini, and I'm a professor of civil engineering at Portland State University.
Thank you, sir. Please proceed.
So think about, I call this Connected Vehicles 101, and I know that people think about different degrees of connectivity. In some ways, all vehicles are connected in one way or the other to something because most people who are driving or who are traveling are carrying some sort of mobile device. But think about what connectivity across a much broader spectrum, perhaps a more robust and resilient communication network, could mean for traffic congestion, for pollution, for crashes, and for weather. So think about the kinds of information that could be transmitted to and from vehicles that are out on the transportation network, vehicles of all kinds, and received by those vehicles and other users of the transportation system, maybe even the operators and maintainers of the transportation system, where we could learn much more about how the system's operating in real time. So Connected Vehicle 101, the idea with connectivity means that there's wireless communications between vehicles and between vehicles and the infrastructure that primarily can be used to prevent crashes, but can also be used to make travel easier, more efficient, reduce pollution, and so on. So trying to get you to think about what this future scenario might be like. The type of communication that we would be talking about is a standard form of communication called dedicated short-range communications. And if there are any electrical engineers here, they probably know what IEEE is. And it's basically a standard when you are communicating using Wi-Fi in this building or Bluetooth with your mobile phone headset or whatever. There are standards for those types of communications. So that means any company, any entrepreneur, any innovator can participate in those communication systems and be competitive. So for transportation, primarily for safety, about 20 years ago, the U.S. Department of Transportation worked with the FCC to set aside some spectrum, which, of course, you know is very valuable. And there are fights going on about this spectrum right now. But basically, at the moment, in Europe, in the U.S., and in Japan, there is a consistent communication slice set aside for transportation and safety, and the acronym is DSRC. So vehicles, no matter what type, some of the pictures here are trying to indicate we're talking about fleets, we're talking about individual private vehicles, so on, motorcycles, transit vehicles, can communicate with each other using this basically slightly enhanced Wi-Fi. Connected vehicles. So the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, NHTSA, who regulates light vehicles, part of the U.S. DOT, their analysis has shown that about 80% of unimpaired crashes, so there are about 6 million crashes in the U.S. every year, resulting in about 30,000 fatalities. So about 80% could be mitigated or prevented using this form of communications, and that's about 50% of total crashes. So if you think, you know, what it would be like to drop from 6 million to 3 million crashes, roughly 30,000 to 15,000 fatalities, that's a huge potential. So there has been some investment at the federal level in studying whether this kind of a system would really work. So if vehicles had such communications capabilities, the idea here is that the device required to to accomplish this form of communication is a relatively low-cost device. So on the order of $100, a device that could contain this kind of a radio that could be communicating to and from the vehicle. That would allow all vehicles, not only the high-end, but anyone's vehicles, even an older vehicle through the purchase of an aftermarket device. So this kind of a system is attainable to everyone, basically. The system, with a little bit of software, could provide warnings of different types to avoid crashes. So there are lots of sort of spin-off opportunities. If you have this kind of a safety device, some of these things have been proven in research labs and on test tracks and in field test deployments. So you could provide all kinds of information to transportation system users regarding parking, transit availability, ride sharing, et cetera. So I would refer to those as convenience-oriented applications. There could, of course, be multiple sustainability-related applications, as I would call them, so eco-driving or solutions aimed at conserving energy. If you had an electric vehicle with such a device that's communicating with the infrastructure, you could perhaps the vehicle would know where you're headed and what the terrain is like and could help you optimize the getting to from point A to point B on your current level of battery charge. So the idea is that connected vehicles are aimed at helping safety, convenience, if you want to call it that, and sustainability. There are a lot of, there was a YouTube video link there. If you have this presentation later, you could take a look at that video. I would like to talk about what intelligent vehicles are available today. I've been talking about a future scenario that's been tested in a laboratory and field tested in a fairly large deployment. But I should also mention that vehicles that are on the market today are relatively intelligent, and you can buy not a promo specifically for Ford, but the Ford Focus at about $21,000-$22,000 is available with 8 or 10 different relatively intelligent features that do not rely on any kind of connectivity with the network. So moving along this spectrum of vehicle technologies in an autonomous way, the Ford Focus you can get with adaptive cruise control that has forward collision warning, so the car will actually, some of you may have experienced this, if you get too close to the car in front of you, the car will warn you and then will put the brakes on for you. And I've been in a Ford vehicle with a Ford engineer who was trying to get me to get closer and closer and closer to the innocent person in front of me just so I could see how it worked. And it's a little nerve-wracking, but it is technology that's on the market today. Blind spot information systems have also been on the market for some time and help you with lane changing. Rear view cameras are more and more available that help with parking lot and backing kinds of situations. Lane keeping alert systems have also been around for several decades, actually, that are particularly good at helping commercial vehicle drivers stay in their lanes. There are parking assist systems. I know a lot of people like those automated parking solutions where you take your hands off the wheel and the car parallel parks. I remember in my driving test we had to parallel park, and that's what everybody was nervous about. So there are other kinds of systems like traffic sign recognitions, other forms of driver alert if the vehicle detects that you're exhibiting some drowsy behavior. And then there are some technologies that help you see pedestrians, and active city stop is something that helps you deal with stop-and-go traffic in congested conditions. What I would like to say about a vision for a connected future is along the lines of what I've been talking about, is this is a future transportation system that involves all kinds of vehicles, including fleets, taxis and transit, and commercial vehicles, electric vehicles. But it's not just about the vehicles, it's also about the people who are using them, the drivers and the operators of those vehicles, because as we know, the drivers are carrying with them handheld mobile devices that are part of the equation. And then it's about the infrastructure. So, of course, in the traditional traffic engineering side of things. We have traffic signals on the city streets, but we also have ramp meters. We have variable message signs, and soon here in Oregon, variable speed limit systems. So all these systems could be integrated. I would also like to add that it's not just highway transportation that we're talking about. It includes the potential to provide linkages at ports with maritime side, and also certainly at railroad grade crossings to improve the potential to link with railroads as they are implementing positive train control systems. There's a big opportunity to link the highway and the rail infrastructure. So I call that a vision for a connected future. Just to provide a little bit of an update from the federal side, the U.S. Department of Transportation has been conducting quite a bit of research in this area, and recently they completed, although it's continuing, what's called the safety pilot in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There are about 3,000 vehicles, connected vehicles, as I've been describing, in the field in Ann Arbor, vehicles of all different types, including trucks and buses, motorcycles, and I think one bicycle. And so they were testing a range of these applications, vehicle-to-vehicle applications like the collision warning kinds of applications that I've mentioned, as well as some systems that allow the vehicles to communicate with traffic signals. So, for example, the traffic signal could detect vehicles approaching in a much more granular way and could optimize the timing of the intersection so it's actually serving the vehicles that are wishing to be served, as opposed to vehicles who may have hit a detector several hundred feet upstream of the signal. So the signals can be much more snappy, of course safe as well, because the signal knows when actually the vehicles are coming. And I would just quickly say that this safety pilot has informed something that we refer to as the NHTSA decision, which just came out in the last couple of weeks, which means that the USDOT is moving forward with a regulatory process that may require these communication devices in all new vehicles. But of course, that process will take several years, and it's just beginning, but I think it sends a signal to the auto industry and to the transportation community that this connectivity is coming. It's definitely been proven through research to be worthwhile, and the question now is, you know, what do we do next as a transportation community? I put some materials in here about DSRC in case any of you are interested in the details. You can read these later, but I've already briefly described what DSRC is. And the reason many people ask, well, why can't we just use regular Wi-Fi? And I would just say that the DSRC standard has in it details that allow this to be much more reliable and much less, and allows for much less latency. So the way to visualize it is if you have two cars coming toward one another at 60 miles per hour, they're communicating 10 times per second. And so you can't have, you know, when you're talking on your cell phone or trying to connect to Wi-Fi, you have call drops and you have signal drops. You can't at that critical kind of situation have those kind of drops. So the DSRC standard allows for higher reliability and less latency to occur. And that's the short answer to that much more complicated question. This slide shows that in a more detailed way, and there are more details there. I thought I would just briefly highlight, I mentioned before, the 80% of the unimpaired crashes that can be dealt with through these kinds of systems. These are basically the six types of crashes that account for the majority of the crashes that are occurring. And so these applications, rear-end warning, lane departure, intersection warning, lane change, opposite direction crashes in passing situations, and a back-over crash have been, the mitigations for these have been demonstrated in Ann Arbor and in other places. I would also say that there is a standard safety message that's been agreed upon that consists of only about a dozen parameters. So yes, you could have very advanced vehicles with all kinds of features and all kinds of applications, but you could also have a relatively simple application with a simple device simply communicating these dozen or so parameters on the lower right of that slide. And so those are the kind of low-cost device, $100-ish device that I mentioned to you before. I would also just like to mention, in society, but also in transportation, we've gone from a desert to an ocean, so there is a lot, let's say, of transportation data out there. Some of it we know as users of the transportation system, we know about, others we don't necessarily know about. And so this shows basically a Google map on the lower right showing colors, green, yellow, red, on all sorts of streets in the Portland metropolitan area, and you can do this any place in the country, and the streets are given colors populated by data from somewhere, probably from people's phones, and they may or may not know that they've actually clicked yes in activating their location services. Of course, we don't really know how accurate these colors are. In places with a lot of traffic, they're probably more accurate than in places with less traffic. But in this revolution, I would just also ask you to visualize with me the current situation where we really don't know individually where people are going. So we do surveys and we have models that allow us to try to estimate what sort of transportation demand there is, and that's pretty good. In the future, we might imagine that we might actually know more in a real-time basis where people are coming from and where they're going in a way that could be helpful to them, to give them information about how to get there quicker or more efficiently. So my friend he lives in Germany. He has a fancy German car, and so he can sit at his desk and type in his destination for his navigation, and then it emails itself to his car. So when he gets in the car knows where he wants to go, and so he doesn't have to retype in the information. So, you know, BMW has that service, so they know also where he is and where he's going, and so they might be able to give him information, you know, about how to get to his destination in a quicker way, or how to do it so he passes by the BMW dealership or something like that. But, you know, in the future, it may be possible to know more about what people are doing through these kinds of systems. Currently, we have a few vehicles that are generating data about where they are on the network, and that's useful if you're managing a fleet of vehicles, for example, taxi fleet or commercial vehicle fleet. In the future, we envision that almost all vehicles will have some sort of connection to the network for safety reasons, for efficiency reasons, for convenience reasons, and so on. And I would just also add that mostly we rely on the infrastructure now with sensors and cameras and other things, and we envision that we will still need connections to the infrastructure in the future. So there are lots of different ways that we will get there. What I wanted to mention is I've talked about safety, but I've also kind of mentioned convenience and mobility and sustainability-related applications, and just ask you to think about, you know, if we knew where a lot of the vehicles in the network were, and if we knew the status of the network, I mean, vehicles themselves can certainly measure the temperature of the pavement. Vehicles can, you know, if you know that a vehicle has hit its brakes suddenly, or if you detect something through the suspension system, you might be able to detect a pothole, or if a vehicle's anti-lock brake systems are activated, you might know that there was an icy patch in that location. So you can get a lot of information from vehicles with existing kinds of sensors and systems that are on the vehicles, but the trick is, how do you consolidate those data in an organized, secure, anonymous, and helpful way? So the idea is that in the future, someone or some groups or some, I don't know, universities or companies or organizations will form this orange ball shown on the slide here. The orange ball is meant to be this sort of clearinghouse for data from the transportation system. Could be a data archive. We've built a data archive at Portland State that is archiving a lot of the ODOT data. We work with TriMet and the City of Portland and so on. But the idea here, without getting into too many details, is that would enable lots of different things. And the U.S. Department of Transportation has kind of grouped those potential applications into about six areas, including traveler information, emergency management, intelligent traffic signal systems, freight management, transit operations, and something called network flow optimization. So managing and operating the system as efficiently as possible. So this is the idea of sort of the mobility side. And what I kind of want to wrap up with is there are a lot of issues surrounding all this, right? This is the beginning of a conversation. There's been a lot of research, but there are lots of policy issues. This is where you come in to think about, you know, how do we handle all these 12 areas and more? How do we take these puzzle pieces and fit them into a system that will actually work for people? I was getting a haircut this morning, and a guy there was, we were talking about liability, because he was asking me why I was wearing a suit to get my haircut, and so we were talking about...
liability was your answer?
Well, we were talking about connected vehicles and autonomous vehicles, and he was saying, well, you know, wow, if you take away the control of a vehicle from users, what happens liability-wise? And, you know, privacy and cybersecurity... these are conversations that we have to have as a transportation community, first of all, but also more broadly in society. There are still a lot of questions about how these systems would be deployed, who would finance them. There are lots of interesting and exciting questions, but also opportunities in these areas. I haven't said much about autonomous vehicles yet, but what I would like to do is show this graphic here to indicate that, in my mind, there's a continuum. We've already got intelligent vehicles out there that are somewhat connected. There's the type of vehicle connectivity that I've been talking about along the lines of dedicated short-range communications for safety. And then somewhere along that further bit of spectrum, if you look at this, the axis on this graph here, there's on the vertical side, there's degree of autonomy, and then on the horizontal side, there's degree of cooperation. So at some point, at the far ends of those two spectrums are what has been called for several decades this concept of an automated highway system, and pieces of that system have been tested. A lot of the research that was done in the late 80s and early 90s, funded by the Federal Highway Administration, sort of then fell into the DARPA challenges that probably many of you have heard about in urban and rural kinds of settings, that then Google hired many of those scientists and engineers to actually do the Google autonomous vehicle. So this kind of research has been going on for a long time, and I wanted to point out that in an autonomous vehicle, the difference is that rather than relying on communications with other vehicles or with the infrastructure, that vehicle itself is fully equipped with the sensing that it needs to do the whole driving task. And so those kinds of sensors currently, the LiDAR device that's spinning around on the top, I understand is about a $300,000 device. And so the idea that this would be something that everybody could have in the short term is probably not too realistic. But I think the interesting thing is, how do all the different vehicle types with different levels of connectivity, different degrees of autonomy and cooperation, how do these all interact together? And of course, you're going to have vehicles like mine, my 15-year-old car, it's going to be out there hopefully for a little bit longer. So we're going to be seeing a mix of vehicle types with different purposes, different kinds of users, and the challenge is, how are we going to grapple with fitting all of those into our transportation system, and in order to achieve the goals that we want to achieve? And actually, how can we think broadly about this as an opportunity and a challenge to improve many, many aspects of our economy and our transportation system? We were talking when Representative Reed came by a few weeks ago, just from a planning standpoint, if we knew more about, you know, how people were going to be traveling 20 or 30 years from now with all these different vehicles, we might think differently about how we would design our cities or design our communities and so on. It's meant to be slightly funny in the sense that Audi developed this timeline saying that starting with the wheel 10,000 years ago, that we've been heading toward the arrival of the autonomous car, and that it's been inevitable with all the developments in transportation technology that we would get here now. It is an interesting and exciting time in the transportation field. I would also briefly mention that a number of different agencies and organizations have been thinking about the automated vehicle questions, the many, many questions that have arisen and that continue to arise, and that there are several different levels of automation, some of which I've already mentioned, that are still before the threshold of turning over any control of any vehicle to a non-human. So there are degrees of automation that are moving down the spectrum, where the vehicle and the computing and sensing capabilities are helping the driver, but is not turning over control to the machine. And this, I thought, was a relatively useful taxonomy that kind of shows that progression from completely human-controlled on the left-hand side with partial assist and partial automation before you cross that dash red line and turning over some control to the machine, as I said before. So I think I'm going to just quote a few predictions so one of my students has been helping on the project that we're working on track some of the published predictions out there, so we just put a few of them down here some companies are saying that they're going to release products. For example, in 2018, Google is expecting to release autonomous car technology, and other automakers are saying that in 2020 or 2025 that these technologies will be available on the market. Certainly, a friend of mine in California, occasionally when he sees a Google car on the road, he'll take a picture of it, hopefully not when he's driving. But so sometimes I get these pictures emailed to me just as a reminder that they're out there. As I'm sure many of you know, there are four states that have allowed autonomous vehicles on their roadways for research purposes: Florida, Michigan, Nevada, and California. And other states have either considered or are considering those technologies. I just thought I would show this picture on the lower right. This is from the mid-90s when the Automated Highway System Research Project was being demonstrated in San Diego. So the idea that cars, all those cars in that platoon are driving hands-free at 60 miles per hour. So the technology to do that in an isolated environment has been around for a while. We now have capabilities on the left-hand side with the Google car that those vehicles can be out mixed with other kinds of traffic. But there are still a lot of questions about whether we would want this system to grow, and if so, how it would work. I would just close and mention that the Oregon Department of Transportation's research program is supporting a project that I'm leading along these lines that we started a few months ago, and we're working with ODOT and the DOT stakeholders to start this conversation about what do we want to do to develop a roadmap for connected vehicles and cooperative systems in the future, and it includes a task doing a scan of what's happening in the world of autonomous vehicles. So we are beginning these conversations internally within the state, and I've enjoyed the chance to give you a quick summary into this topic, and I'd be happy to have some discussion or questions if you have time.
I think we do. Thank you, Dr. Puccini. And we should also thank ODOT for making for facilitating the study and helping us connect with you. Are there questions for Dr. Puccini? Representative Lively.
So, Dr. King, I have a question first about connectivity. So when
yes.
you're talking about connectivity cars, you're talking about them connecting to each other and to other things in the environment, not just the internal capabilities of doing it, but actually doing it.
That's correct. So, I mean, all vehicles have communication systems internally to them now,
yep.
and many, many people's vehicles have some sort of connectivity for their stereo or the integration with their cell phone and hands-free and those kinds of things. But the connectivity that I'm talking about is one level
yep.
along that continuum where it's a more robust form of communication, allowing vehicles to talk to one another and to the infrastructure.
Please.
Sure. And so the other question I have, you talked some about this kind of this transition because of age of cars and things.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about the devices. So I have a car that has a lot of those things kind of built into the car. But then you talked about for $100 being able to buy a device. And so I'm trying to understand what that device, other than sitting there and somebody watching it and doing something, versus what else would it be capable of doing?
Sure. I can talk about, so certainly there are some different tracks here. So certainly there's the track that NHTSA is pursuing with a regulation that might require new vehicles to contain this capability. And most auto manufacturers in the U.S. have indicated that they're going to do this anyway in the next year or two, the connectivity piece, so that that would be built into the vehicle. And it is, you know, I say it's relatively low cost, but anything, any new thing in a vehicle to a manufacturer is a big thing. So even, you know, something that costs 5 cents is a big item for them. There would be, so in this Michigan field test that I mentioned, they had about 60 vehicles that were essentially built by auto manufacturers to emulate what a new vehicle off the lot would look like with this system in it. And then there were several tiers of aftermarket devices. So some vehicles, a few hundred vehicles, had devices that were kind of like a navigation, a Garmin, if you know what I mean, a navigation system kind of unit that was actually implanted into the vehicle by a, you know, by a, not necessarily a manufacturer, but a qualified person installed this device that had some of those safety features built into it. So that was integrated into the vehicle professionally, if you will. Then there were a few thousand aftermarket devices that were really just handheld devices that were simply doing what I indicated as the safety message. So they weren't getting the convenience benefits or applications, but for a relatively low cost, $100-ish cost, they were participants in the system, streaming out their position and their location, their information, so they could participate in the safety aspects. Oh,
good, thank you.
Other questions? Representative?
I'm hoping that as the conversations continue, that there's a lot more discussion about security issues.
Yeah.
Everyone's pretty sensitive right now about what happens with identity theft, financial fraud, and other sorts of issues that happen with intrusions into systems. This could be damaging and alarming in a way that we have not yet experienced.
Well, I completely agree that we would roughly categorize this in the realm of cybersecurity, but I think there are in the research that's been done so far, the cybersecurity layer of this has been extremely important and critical. You couldn't have vehicles participating in a system that that has a fail-safe component without assurance that these are real vehicles, that these are not that there are no rogue possibilities to get into the system. So it absolutely, you know, the system's not going to work without those kinds of assurances. And there's no question in my mind that, you know, if the public, I mean, our citizens who are going to be using these systems, they need to see that the benefits, safety benefits, the convenience benefits, whatever the benefits are, must outweigh the cost, the real cost of buying the hardware, participating in the system, but also the kind of scary aspects, you know. So they're going to have to, that equation is going to have to be really, really well demonstrated.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
There's one way in which I view the potential dangers of this differently than identity theft and financial fraud. With those sorts of things, we all make individual choices, like whether we want to load an app on our cell phone or whether we want to do online banking through a computer or, you know, a cell phone or a laptop, some other mobile device. We make those decisions, and we're weighing the risk of potential harm to ourselves or perhaps our family. I guess your friends get wrapped up into it if your email is hacked and people start getting spam messages, but largely I believe we're making those decisions based on a benefit-risk analysis to ourselves. If someone did something to a vehicle on a highway, it's not just the potential harm to the individual whose car we're talking about. It's potential harm to dozens or hundreds or more who were not involved.
In short, I agree. And so I think it is and will continue to be an important, maybe, as you said, the most important element.
Thank you.
Robert, what other states and countries are doing smart things to get prepared, and what are they?
Yeah, so I think, well, in... So I mentioned Europe and the U.S. and Japan have been working together. What I didn't really make clear before is that I spent a couple of years, I was on a leave of absence from Portland State, and I was working at the U.S. Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C. a few years ago. So we were involved in conversations with Europe and Japan and some other countries, first of all, to try to standardize the kinds of communication that we're talking about between vehicles and between the infrastructure. And my understanding is that on the European standards making organizations, just in the last few days, I read that they've basically finalized their standards, and the U.S. Is trailing behind that a little bit. So I think standards are really important. It's been an important element of the research that's been done in this area, nationally and internationally, because it makes certain that U.S. firms can compete in this environment and can compete in a global way. So I'd say standards development is really important. That's not really my area of expertise. The standards world is a world in and of itself. I should compliment ODOT for funding the project idea that I submitted for at least beginning the conversation here. Certainly Oregon is looked upon as a leader in transportation, has been looked upon that way for over 100 years. And in my time in Washington, D.C., a lot of people were really interested in watching what was happening in Oregon in lots of different ways. So I don't want to forget to say that. I think, from what I understand, so Michigan is probably the one state that has been the leader in this area, maybe for obvious reasons, because they're the home of the auto industry, but I think their DOT director has been a very active participant in these kinds of programs. I know that in Texas, they're working on, they have an Accelerate Texas program within the transportation arena where they're trying to see what sort of accelerations they should be making in technology deployment and technology adoption. I think also Florida has been pretty active in this arena as well. In the area of autonomous vehicles, I think Nevada was the first state to allow autonomous vehicles and to figure out a way to license them and register operators of those within Nevada. I think that is linked to the hosting of the CES in Las Vegas every year, so they're trying to encourage innovation, and I think they've maybe been successful there. In Europe, they funded a lot of research. They fund research in a different way than we do here in the U.S., and they have a European-wide program that comes out every year, and that they encourage private sector participation and universities and government agencies. And they've done quite a bit of research in this area, all kinds of different projects. They did a project. We're actually leaning on some of the results of their project for the ODOT research project. You know, what would we need to have in place on day one of a connectivity or cooperative system, on opening day? What kinds of things would need to be in place? So we will be doing an assessment of those, of their results, and seeing which ones of those apply here in Oregon. So those are a couple thoughts. In Japan, they've actually deployed several thousand on their expressway network, several thousand devices that allow vehicles to communicate from the infrastructure to the vehicles. And there are products available on the market in Japan, mostly through navigation systems, which basically everyone has a navigation system in their vehicle in Japan and has had for several decades. So those are just a few examples.
Great. Thank you.
I imagine we will have you back when your research is completed. But in the meantime, do you have any advice for us as the Transportation Economic Development Committee? Things that we should be looking at or anticipating in your early stages?
Well, I think being open to this kind of conversation, I think, is really crucial. So I applaud you for that. I mean, you're in touch with citizens who you represent, and so you can help. it make the communication two-way, you know, to make sure that you're passing on to people who are studying this what citizens are thinking about, but also to pass back sort of the things that ODOT and other transportation agencies are doing. I gave a presentation at a meeting of traffic engineers. I mean, I'm sure that you would feel right at home with about 50 or 60 traffic engineers in the room, you know. So a colleague from Oregon State and I, Haizhong Wang, he's also participating in this project, and so we were asking the traffic engineers to think about what the future would be like with connected and autonomous vehicles, and they were actually pretty engaged and pretty excited about the possibilities, and they want to be part of the conversation as well. And I think one of the concerns that we have is that there's this research going on, you know, private companies, universities are on test tracks and in other places are studying these new vehicle concepts, but they aren't really talking to the traffic engineers. And so the traffic engineers are the ones who are running the traffic signals in all the communities all over Oregon and all over the country. And so I think making sure that, that you know, the advice I would have would be make sure that people are at the table who need to be at the table. The jigsaw puzzle that I showed, you know, an area that I know very little about is the insurance industry. I have no clue what insurance experts are thinking about in terms of liability solutions for the future. I mean, how is all this going to work? It's very complicated. So those are maybe not well thought out bits of advice, but just a few points that come to mind.
Very, very helpful, thank you. And I think that is actually my favorite slide of amongst all your other ones. Yeah. That are.
You're welcome to steal it.
It's not quite as exciting and inspiring as it is daunting about the work in front of us, but really underscores the importance of it. So we appreciate it.
Yeah, I guess maybe the last thing I would say would be that I think we have an opportunity even without. Without some of the scary aspects of, like we were talking about with cybersecurity and so on, the idea that we can know more about how the system is operating so that we can manage it better is actually quite important. It helps from the perspective of managing agencies, managing resources. I mean, managing traffic and transportation is something I think that everybody feels like we want to pay attention to in the future. So I think this is a huge opportunity to accomplish a lot of our goals.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Representative Cameron?
Well, I was just looking at the bike lane, Mr. Chair. What time of day was this?
No, it's not. It's a photo I think I stole from the PSU website. So this is probably, I would guess, in the
5 o'clock.
Late afternoon.
At the chair's request, I bet you want to update that and have some bikes in there.
Yes, you're correct. You're correct.
No, you're the chair.
I'm just speaking on your behalf.
Oh, thank you.
Thank
you so much. You're
correct.
We'll be glad to have you back when there's an update and the
thank you.
Rest of the research.
Well, I had a
thank
name
you so much.
Earlier today.
Yeah, I saw that. You were the vice chair for a little bit.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
So we close the informational meeting, and we're going to take a brief recess while we reset for our public hearing on Senate Bill 1502. 5 minutes, Patrick?
5 minutes should be fine.
5 minutes. We'll be in recess for 5 minutes.
Open a work session all about that.
Committee will come back to order, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1502.
Okay. Patrick? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1502 comes to us with a Senate floor vote of 21-9. It increases the number of vehicles in the road usage charge pilot project from 5,000 to 10,000, effective July 1st, 2015. There's limitation on funds from participation of other states and provinces in the pilot project. It revises the load weight tables for vehicles and vehicle combinations operating under variance permits with distance between fertilized axles, et cetera, et cetera. I'll let the people who are going to testify get into the gory details about self-loading log trucks, Mr. Chair. It transfers monies between projects funded under House Bill 2001 from 2009. It would take effect on the 91st day of following adjournment signing die. We have a dash A10 amendment, which I believe Senator Starr will speak to.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Representative Huffman, if you'd like to join us, we'd be glad to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to testify with you in front of you this afternoon. I am Senator Bruce Starr from Hillsborough, representing Senate District 15, here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1502, both the base bill and the dash A10 amendments. As Mr. Brennan so ably relayed to you, the base bill came across the Senate floor with a pretty strong bipartisan vote. And I won't go through the three things that are in the base bill. I will talk to the A10 amendments. The A10 amendments are a product of conversations that have occurred between a number of us, including the chair of this committee and other senators, including myself. Senator Johnson would be here, except that she had to go give a speech to the Airport Managers Association, I believe. The A10 amendments do a couple of things. Section 6 of the amendment allocates some dollars that we believe are left unexpended in the OTIA 3 program, the bridge program. You can see there in the Section 6 of the A10 amendments how some of those resources are reallocated. This is not something that the legislature hasn't done before. We've told the department how to spend certain dollars when they do a good job and have dollars that are left on the table. I believe it's within the legislative purview to help direct where those remaining dollars are spent. Section 7 of the bill talks about a jurisdictional transfer of a couple of roads, one of them on the west side in Washington and Multnomah County, that's Cornelius Pass Road, one on the east side, that's Milliken Road, that is incorporated, or it's in Crook County and Deschutes County. Working with Director Garrett, we believe that we can give him some time to negotiate with those local jurisdictions on a transfer. That, as you can note in the amendment, Section 7, there's a deadline to the director to get that negotiation completed. It's my intention that I believe, and I'll speak particularly on the Cornelius Pass Road because that's the one I know most about, that it's appropriate that specific road be a state facility. It is really a freight route. It connects Highway 30 and Highway 26. Hazardous material that comes from the Port of Portland out to Washington County comes most all of it through that facility. Any of you that are aware of it know that it's a windy, dangerous road alongside of a waterway that that we really ought to spend some dollars on. No disrespect intended, but the counties, it's just not that high of a priority. And if it becomes a state facility, we as state legislators can help to direct the department to expend the resources on that road. This bill, I will say, does not specifically identify any kind of improvement and doesn't allocate any dollars. That is something that a future legislature can take up at a future time. Section 9 of the bill, or the amendment, deals with issues out in East Portland, I believe, at the request of Representative Fagan. You can read that. And then Section 10 of the amendment is a part of the amendment that I believe Representative Huffman could speak to directly, having to do with the renaming of section of U.S. Highway 26. Mr. Chair, I understand that the director has a perspective on Section 6 of the bill, and I appreciate that. I would ask that you at least move the amendment in total to the Rules Committee so that we can continue the conversation with the director as it relates to specifically Section 6 of the bill. My understanding is that's the plan, but that would allow us to continue the conversation with the director. As you will note, members of the committee and anyone listening on the internet, the A-10s have nothing to do with the Columbia River crossing. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and let my my colleague talk about the parts of the amendment that he cares about.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Let's hear from Representative Huffman, and we are going to hear from the director after you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Huffman, House Representative for District 59. I am thrilled to be here to support the Dash A-10s. It's been somewhat of a moving target, but I do support the whole amendment and the underlying bill. But a bill that you guys heard about a week ago today on the House floor, we had to squeak in another bill even after we passed it by a large majority last week. It has to do with Warm Springs veterans. And they've been working with ODOT, and they have a desire to name the 35-mile stretch of Highway 26 through the reservation the Warm Springs Veterans Memorial Highway. It's that simple. They've already got the agreements in place with ODOT. ODOT's ready to go. No fiscal on it. It's pretty simple. We all liked it last Monday. I'm hoping you'll all like it again today.
Questions for Representative Huffman and Senator Starr? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We appreciate
Thank you. Thank you.
Director Garrett. And while you're coming up, I have to tease you a little bit. I noticed on the sign-up sheet here we have a Matthew director. I'm just making the assumption that that's you.
Wow.
Mr. Chairman, we'll have to talk to staff about that.
Director.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's a privilege to be here. I'm going to be clear and concise, specific to 1502 and the A-10 amendments here. I'm going to speak surgically about Section 6. And as I do have a perspective on it, I have some concerns to share with you in terms of the allocation of the $25.85 million for the five projects listed. The reality is the savings did appear. As a matter of fact, we were very successful, and I think the successful delivery of the OTIA 3 bridge program allows us to have this conversation, and we did deliver under budget, so to speak. We do have one project I'll speak about with regard to OTIA 3 still underway, but we delivered it successfully under budget to the tune of at least $45 million, I will tell you. With that savings, back in January of 2013, my commission has already allocated that money to Pioneer Mountain Eddyville. You'll recall that is a U.S. 20 project that we've had some challenges on. It needed investment to complete that connection between the valley and the coast. And those funds, those savings from the OTA3 bridge program, $45 million, as well as some other revenue sources that were realized, went into that investment. So when all is said and done, as we speak to the first part of it, I have a concern that there's no savings existing. Now, I will say this. We continue to move forward. We are on the bell lap of delivering the OTIA 3 bridge program. We have one bridge that's playing itself out in Troutdale. It's the Sandy River Bridge. And as we forecast out to the end of that is to be completed by the end of this calendar year. We see a reserve of about $9.7 million. I've handed out a document that kind of walks through in the most gross level on accounting for it. And I just ask you to go to the very bottom of the page, the last three lines. And what you'll see is $1.3 billion in terms of the program target. You'll see the allocation of $45 million that went from the commission to Pioneer Mountain Eddyville. And then you'll see a program reserve of $9.749 million. Now, that's above and beyond. That is savings that exist right now. But as we look at claims that exist on several projects that made up the bridge work of OTIA 3, as well as just the unfinished business of delivering that significant and complex bridge in Troutdale, we see all the exposures there, and they total about $8 million or so. So when all is said and done, it may be a push. There may be $1 million when all is said and done, depending on how those claims and how the exposures break over the course of the next year. So that's my first concern, is that the monies that were targeted have been allocated to a very critical project on US 20. The second issue and the second document I handed you is literally a mechanical or procedural issue in terms of how you allocate savings from the Jobs and Transportation, from the OTIA 3 program. And you can see House Bill 3415 coming out of the 2005 legislative session, which is now Chapter Law 486, walks through a hierarchy that you target projects of statewide significance. Those were eight projects that were identified by the commission several years ago, projects such as the Columbia River Crossing, but more importantly, the Sunrise Corridor in Clackamas County, 205, Newburgh-Dundee, Highway 20 Pioneer Mountain-Eddyville, as well as Highway 62 down in the Medford area here. Those were identified, and you can see the language has 75% of the savings going to those type projects, and then 25% of the savings that exist going to freight projects. Again, consistent with this language, the allocation from the commission, both Pioneer Mountain-Eddyville is a project of statewide significance. It is also a significant freight route for the Georgia Pacific Mill and the migration from the coast to the valley and back and forth. So there's a mechanical problem in terms of how you would insert the projects identified here with the protocols identified in law. And then the final thing that I must say that concerns me is one of allocating monies to these projects is somewhat of a one-off discussion from a fairly robust engagement we just finished with regard to our STIP process, where at the beginning of the process a couple years ago, we created a universe of projects that we vetted with our area commissions on transportation. Our commission, a back-and-forth dialogue up in the Portland metro area, it played itself out at Metro and the JPAC Policy Advising Forum, started with over 300 or so projects, totaling $675 million, and then eventually refining that down to the 102 projects that were selected by the commission, a total of about $185 million just recently here. So, again, none of these projects actually engaged that process, and that concerns me that we're having a one-off conversation from the more disciplined or focused, comprehensive discussion that took place. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the three issues that I had specific to Section 6. We're very comfortable with the language that's contained in the remainder of the A-10s. We've worked that over on the Senate side, and we're very comfortable with the direction that went. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, sir. Questions for the Director?
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. That's the entire list of people who want to testify on Senate Bill 1502. Anyone else want to come up? I don't see any. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1502. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1502. Representative Gorsuch?
Mr. Chair, I move that the Senate Bill 1502-A10 amendment dated 2/21/14 be adopted.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch moves that the -A10 amendment to Senate Bill 1502 dated 2/21/14 be adopted. Is there any discussion? Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, maybe I should ask the director this. So we passed these amendments. What happens? Where's the conflict resolved? How is the conflict resolved for the money that's already been allocated versus what this bill's saying to do?
Representative Cameron, my answer to that question would be that it would come in the motion that I expect will follow, which would be to send the bill on to the Rules Committee. As Senator Starr indicated, an interest in continuing the discussion, given that this is our last meeting as a Transportation and Economic Development Committee where we can take action. I for one, am hopeful that the discussion can continue in the Rules Committee and be ironed out there.
So, Mr. Chair, that we're going to adopt some amendments that potentially have a conflict that we don't know about. So I'll probably be a no on these amendments, just
okay.
Before I...
Very good. Thank you. Other questions? Any objections noting Representative Cameron's? Seeing no further objections, the motion carries. -A10 amendments are adopted. Representative Gorsuch.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1502 without having the fiscal impact and revenue impact statements on hand at this time.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1502 without having the fiscal and revenue impact statements on hand. The motion is not debatable. Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion passes. Representative Gorsuch.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1502 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the measure be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch has moved Senate Bill 1502 as amended to the Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation. And before I ask if there's any discussion, I just want to say for myself that I'm very much in, find myself in alignment with the comment Senator Starr made about continuing the conversation. I think the Director made some good points, and I'm particularly persuaded about taking this action for two reasons. One, because it's our last opportunity to take any action on this bill, and because there is one piece of the bill that that needs some further discussion and several other parts of the bill that a lot of people are interested in that don't seem to be of any objection. So that's my statement on it. Is there other discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if there was no recommendation in the motion, I could probably support the motion, but since we're recommending they do pass and the conflicts that I don't have explained to me yet, I can't vote for a do pass recommendation until I have those questions answered, so I will be a no.
Understood. Thank you, sir. Other questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be a yes on the bill, but with reservations, and as so often is the case when we have a bill of this nature with so many things in it, there's, you know, you want to be a yes, you want to be a no.
Yes.
But the, no. There are enough things in here that I know are positive that I believe the discussion should continue, even though I share Representative Cameron's concerns about Director Garrett's remarks.
Understood. Thank you. Other comments? And noting Representative Cameron's objection, are there any other objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. Senate Bill 1502 as amended heads to the Rules Committee. Thank you for that. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1502. We don't have any other business to come before the committee except to note that this is the opportunity for Representative Cameron's farewell speech, at least to this committee. So, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Yes. Chair.
Can you cue the music
for
first?
A moment.
Can you turn the music on first, please?
He gets a couple minutes before the music starts.
Oh, then he'll go. Okay. Yeah. It crescendos, I see.
That's right. Hey, Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you've done a great job leading this committee, and that's all I'll say. And I just thought you had given me a promotion my last committee, but since you took that away, then maybe I'll take my words away.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Representative Cameron. Anything else to come before the committee? Seeing nothing else, we're adjourned. Thank you. Anything else? We're adjourned. Thank you.